Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 47, part 2, where we continue to discuss Albert and Wenton's 1985 text, Organizational Identity. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. In this part of the podcast, we're going to look at related themes that we see in the article and how that pertains to current phenomena that might be in industry or literature and the management issues related to this investigation that the authors conducted.
So what I also have with me is an article that's titled Albert and Wenton Revisited, Strengthening the Concept of Organization Identity. And this was written a full 20 years after Albert and Wenton, 1985.
And we'll put a link to that on the show, in the notes, so that you'll be able to download that and read it yourself.
Absolutely. And there's a very, very telling paragraph in this that very early in this later paper that kind of shows that, yeah, we started off with these 7 empirical questions, 33 hypotheses, and a considerable amount of work was done. But there were some challenges that came up in terms of really putting some rigor behind the concept and really making it practical. And one particular telling paragraph just sort of shows, and it's something that David Wenton said was sort of implied within the original article, but wasn't very explicit. And I'll just read it straight out. The Albert and Wenton description of organization identity contained 3 principal components. Although we didn't use these terms, the ideational component equated organizational identity with members' shared belief regarding the question, who are we as an organization? The definitional component proposed a specific conceptual domain for organizational identity, characterized as the features of an organization. And finally, the phenomenological component posited that identity-related discourse was most likely to be observed in conjunction with profound organizational experiences. Put another way, you had the ideational piece, which is about what the organization claims to be, but may not necessarily be. This is who we are. We're number one, even though, like using a football analogy, we're somewhere very low down in the table, but we still claim to be number one. Okay? Then the definitional, of course, is characterized most directly by what the claims are of central character, distinctiveness, and temporal continuity or history, which is sort of factual, but it's sort of ideational as well. But it's basically how the organization sees itself. And then the phenomenological is, well, this is what we actually do. And it's a lot of times, you know, you can see how even those 3 lenses can lead to what the organization says may not necessarily be what it does and may not necessarily be who the organization is. So they all kind of stem from the same identity construct, but you can see how these conflicts can occur.
Right. In fact, it's a lot like individual identity, where people will often say, I am this thing. And this other conception of identity is it's not what you say you are, it's what you do. And that's what you were talking about, Tom. An organization says, well, this is what we think we are, so what we claim to be. And then you have to actually go look at, well, what do you do? And does that square or is that coherent with your conception of what you do?
Yeah, I agree with that. And one thing that came to my mind is also how others see the organization. Whereas the paper is very much written from inside the organization, defining the identity and really like seeing it as self-definition and self-realization, companies also have to face that they're being defined by others, by companies they're working with, by their customers, by the general society. We don't know where you would put that.
Right. That's a great insight. Yeah, that's a great insight, though, is that maybe not missing, but that's a part that they underemphasized for sure. And we see today with the, I think, rise of social media is one of these aspects, but it's probably not the only one, where you can very quickly as an organization, and particularly a global organization or global enterprise, lose control of how others see you, because you're either slow to respond or this other kind of word gets out there. And in many cases, this is what I find is fascinating. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. Truth has very little to do with it. And I'm not criticizing it, but that's just what companies have to deal with. And so a precursor to that in the United States, I think, were the engineers and finance people that ran utilities that thought, oh, this nuclear energy is a great thing, and we'll get on this bandwagon and produce these nuclear power plants. And I'm not coming down one side or the other for nuclear energy. But they were all engineers and finance people. So they just said, okay, well, it's the finances work out, and this is what we're going to go do, and here's how the engineering works. And they found out later that the public perception was a huge issue that they had to address. And you could make the argument that engineers and finance people are not the best ones to take on public perception, because they just don't think that way. So anyway, I think that's Greta's observation about that concern you have to have for how others see you is really important.
Yeah, it's also a challenge, you know, when we think about, say, in a lot of businesses, where in a ways, because we're not members of the organization permanently, we can have a dual identity as being members of the organization and a customer of the organization at the same time. And the example that just sort of comes to my mind, I don't want to call out a specific fast food chain, but think about a fast food chain who decides, for perfectly legitimate reasons, you know, market studies or what have you, decide that they're going to get into salads. Okay. And now we can put all the logic aside. This is it really should be a brilliant idea. If you're concerned about the obesity epidemic, if you're concerned about the health of your customers, if you're concerned about catering to changing tastes and all that sort of thing, you've got all of these reasons why you should be able to embrace the idea of being able to provide this other service. But then you run into the issue of identity, not just internal identity, but also, you know, who others think you are. And if I'm going to go consume salads, I'm just not going to go to a fast food restaurant that serves hamburgers and French fries as their dominant, you know, product, what I think is their dominant product. I'm sorry. I'll go to a place where salads is part of their central character. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, they're going to do it better or differently. And one of the challenges of this is, I think it's a fascinating illustration that you brought up, Tom, because that's a struggle with the global and multinational fast food restaurants, you know, most of which originate in the United States. Is they got to their positions of influence and importance through mass production and consistent product that's always, and it's the same in many, many places. And I think one that Tom is alluding to, it wasn't just that, well, he doesn't think of going to a place like that for salad, but I think you also know mass produced salad is not what you're looking for, right? You're looking for something that's locally produced and you know is fresh and those kinds of things. And I think they're struggling with their identity and not only how customers perceive them, but are you actually even able to produce a salad, for example, or something like that that's pretty fresh in a mass production sort of way. So one example that comes to mind, and since we're not using names, I won't use one as one, but I noticed this when I was in Europe, that there's a American multinational fast food restaurant that's in Europe, and there's many of them, so I'm not singling one out, but they changed their logo, the color of their logo, from the color it was in the United States to a different color in Europe. And so when I saw that, I thought, what is going on with that? You know, it's like this particular restaurant, I did some research and I found out they were being criticized by Europeans for not being local enough and not being integrated with the economy. And so they said they changed the color to send this message. And you could argue about whether that was successful or not, that they were more environmentally conscious and contributed to local economies and were buying from local farmers and, you know, those kinds of things. to work on their image and there's this perception. So I'm not qualified to say whether that worked or not, but I do know that when you go in those restaurants, you have these video monitors where they're playing commercials that are not just about the fast food. It's about this experience of having a birthday party or, you know, buying from the local farmer. I thought it was really interesting how there's this, they have this duality that goes beyond just serving hot food well and more about how they do it and the experience that you have.
Yes, very fascinating. And what you mentioned about, like, as a company, you have like two products you're serving your customers, hamburgers and fries, and now you also serve salads, is actually a question that many organizations face in terms of like product expansion or deepening or focusing on specific products. And in the 2006 paper, they do talk about these, that identity-related discourse is most likely to be observed in conjunction with profound organizational experiences. And I was thinking, while I was reading, what are these profound organizational experiences? And we already talked about this analogy with funerals. And one of the things that came to my mind, thinking about mourning and funerals and saying goodbye to things, is in the field of technology and innovation, where as a technology firm, you invest in developing new products. You know that not every innovation or every new technology is going to make it. But you have these teams of people in your organization that are really passionate about what they're working on. And then there's this decision to either, yes, we will invest in this new technology or in this innovation. We will go for it, introduce a new product in the market. Or you say goodbye to it. And often that's a profound organizational experience for the members that have been involved. Where they start to rethink what type of organization they are working for, what type of work they actually do.
You almost have to have as your central character to be part of that sub-organization that's doing the experimental work is that we are a temporary entity, or we are walking on eggshells, or we could go away at any given time. And sometimes, you know, because when you're in that type of a sub-organization, like we talked about briefly in part one, you're inheriting from two different directions. You know, this is that duality that really does come in, where you're saying you're part of the big organization that says that, you know, especially if you're coming into an organization that, as part of its central character, claims to really take care of its people. And then you have a sub-organization whose character is completely different in terms of their standing in the organization. You're a little bit more expendable. Your value of the organization is based on whether your experiment succeeds or fails. And that duality can definitely be a stress creator, just as it is similar types of duality that you would find in individual identity.
And one related theme that they also briefly touch upon is this link with organizational culture. And we already talked a bit about image. I'm curious how you... So in the article, they talk about that aspects of organizational culture, when they are enduring, they can be part of an organizational identity when you see it as distinctive from other organizations.
And I think that's true, Greta. And I also think what my experience in the military is we do that to create a sense of cohesiveness and commitment. In addition to, and this is one of the things I'm not sure was covered very well in the articles, but it will probably be on the scope of them, is in many organizations, whether it's military or multinational, it's not possible to create a rule or necessarily a guideline for every single situation you're going to face. And I think people largely accept that. And one of the things I've seen in the military is that we will use these organizational identities and tie them to culture, as you were talking about, as a way of helping people make sense of the world and know how to act in consonance with the organizational identity and the culture in ambiguous situations, because many organizations, the people at the working level face quite a bit of ambiguity. And if you try, I don't think it's feasible to reduce that all to just rules. And I'll give you an example in a minute. So I think that's why you have to have these principles of the culture and the organization identity to give people some guidance, but you've got to be consistent. So the bad example I'll give you is I was at a conference once when a person was speaking. She was a union representative, and she was talking about a organization that did industrial and organizational laundry, right? So not very exciting, but basically they take the sheets and pillowcases and towels and uniforms from hotels and other organizations and do mass production, laundry and washing and ironing and then sending these back in big bags. And they were having a problem with the workers were getting hurt in the machines because the machines would break down and they would be fiddling with them and hurt themselves. And so they put these great big signs up on the machine, said, do not tamper with the machines. And if you have a problem, call maintenance. And they noticed that the accident rate did not decrease. And the union that was helping management and the employees address this problem, they looked at the details and they found out, well, the employees have these quotas they have to achieve for a number of sheets washed per hour or shirts ironed or towels folded or something like that. And if they didn't meet their quota, it didn't matter what the machine was doing. They could get fired, or they wouldn't be retained. And maintenance was slow to come. And so there's other aspects of the organizational identity or how it was actually realized in the ground working rules or the boots on ground working rules that were completely in conflict with what they said they were about or that they wanted to take care of the people. And it wasn't until this was pointed out to them that they realized this conflict. And I'm not sure how that was resolved exactly, but I thought it was fascinating that you'd have this, because you would say, I would say, okay, we have these rules and you want to take care of the people. No, they didn't change the other rules that caused the people that were actually much more incentivizing for workers to be the opposite of what the company said. So I think that's another interesting aspect of organizational identity and culture is you can say one thing, right? You can have these conversations and this discourse, but unless you do the detailed work of saying, well, how do our policies relate to all that stuff? And do they work together? Doesn't matter.
And I think that one of the pitfalls that we risk in, say, larger organizations, because again, going back to our conversation about who we were as a podcast, when you're in larger organizations, you know, obviously not everybody knows all about the organization to be able to understand or capture all of those nuances of decisions made up at the top that translate to strange or conflicting behavior at the front lines.
No, absolutely not. That's a classic problem.
It's a classic problem. So then the challenge that I see when we look at these three components, the ideational, the phenomenological, and the definitional that they discuss, is that if you aren't comfortable or your knowledge of your own organization is limited from where you are in at the high perch, which of these are you going to relate to or depend upon first? And the answer is going to be the ideational.
Probably. And that's what's fascinating about that, Tom, is that it's not as if, you know, the people don't know what the reasons are. They decide on their own what the reasons were. And perhaps the ideational one dominated. But I think that's fascinating. It's not like there's a void. They fill the void. You just don't have much control over how they do it.
Yeah, exactly. And then you start having things where, you know, you remember the days of when strong culture was in vogue. And we've had episodes that discuss some of the outcomes of that. You know, you can kind of see the same thing almost. It may even be the exact same phenomena when we talk about like a strong identity. You try to impose it from the top. And that can definitely create problems if it is not an identity that the members can identify with, or that they don't see it as who they are as a person, which then therefore affects the commitment and the climate of the organization.
Fascinating, right? Because up until now, we've talked about how they would be congruent. You're pointing out not always, and that causes problems.
And there you also touch upon this idea I have while reading these readings, it looks like the organizational identity is a very shapeable thing. But actually what I feel is that actually it's something that happens. You don't always have control over it, because it's always this combination of how you see yourself and how you're viewed by others. And that might not only be inside your organization and outside, but might also be top management trying to change identity, and the employees on the work floor not recognizing themselves in like the new identity proposed to them.
Right, or actually even resisting, which I've seen happen before.
Yeah.
And that's I think your insight's fascinating there, right? Because it's one thing to say, oh yes, we'll construct organizational identity, or you can ask questions about it. And I love the way you said that. Organizational identity happens.
Wetton talks a bit about this distinction between the identity of organizations and identity in organizations. And I'd love to have read more about that distinction. But he says organizational identity is about the identity of the organization, not within. But I do think when you go through these processes of organizational change, and his notion of dual identity is a lot about identities in organizations.
Well, it does remind me of the discussion about whether culture is culture a noun or is culture a verb. And I borrowed from Dave Schwant in Change. You know, it was the same kind of an idea. And we think about identity, and I think it is true that there's the same idea of it's both a noun and a verb applies to identity. Now, ultimately, when we talk about everything that you say or do or are is part of your, or is either a part of your identity or it's an expression of your identity. It's also, I think it also is kind of the same as what you don't say, don't do, or aren't.
That's a great way to look at it. The anti-identity part.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily disidentification, which I think we can talk about as well. But, you know, part of your central character is also what you don't do. You refuse to do. You decline to do.
You choose not to do, right? It's a conscious choice, as opposed to saying, well, I forgot to do this, or I wasn't thinking about that. You actually choose not to do it. Yes.
And what that does, you know, when we talk about the ideational aspects and say the top-down leadership of trying to impose an identity upon the organization, it's not just what they want the organization to do. It can also be what they don't want the organization to do or don't want the organization to be anymore. And that can be very, very conflicting, because of course, communicating negatives is actually a lot, you know, my own experience, communicating negatives is considerably harder to express than positives. Very tricky.
Yes, it's very tricky. Yeah, it's very tricky. Yeah, and I would say the one thing I found from my experience about communicating negatives is it's tricky. However, it's actually stickier than the positives, right? Because when you're saying positives, you say things like we can take care of our people, we value what they do, and we want to help their professional development. Just as an example, which I think are good things, they're kind of aspirational. But when you talk about what you don't want to do, you tend to have to get very specific. I'm not sure what your experience is, but you have to say things like, you know, we won't fund your training experience, or we don't want you to leave this company after we invest in this kind of training. You get very, very specific. That's what I noticed about negative things. And when I was trying to teach people about actually some of the things that were part of our organizational identity, I often would go negative quickly, because you could be very specific. Now, of course, it wasn't always easy to generalize, but it's very powerful, that aspect of the negative statements of identity.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's also where the continuity comes in, right? Where when you have to make decisions about what part of the business not to continue anymore, or what affiliations to close down. there you make hard decisions how you want to continue as an organization, but that might also appear to others as a discontinuity. Because they are, it's easier to expand because you still continue everything you do, you just do something more. But if you have to cut away a part.
Yes, actually, and so when I was working in the military, I never had a problem doing that when people would say, okay, well, we want you to cut budget this or what have you. So a lot of people would say, well, we can't do that. And I always thought it was a more interesting intellectual exercise to say, we can stop doing that. We'll just stop doing this thing. And what I thought was fascinating was the enormous strong reactions I would get, not necessarily from the people at the working level. I mean, that was one issue, but these strong reactions I would get from the people at the senior level. It's like, well, no, I want you to do all this stuff. I said, well, I don't have the budget for it, so I'm going to stop doing this thing. No, you have to keep doing that. Well, I'm going to stop doing this thing. And so a couple times I actually intentionally created that conversation in order to get the people to see, if you still want me to do all these kinds of things and you don't have the power to help me reorganize, then you really can't cut the money because I have to stop doing something. And I thought that was a good way to have that conversation, with them.
And in a way, the authors say something very interesting about this. And that is that actually in most organizations now, we have like dual or multiple identities. And when you're going to a period of budget costs and you have to reevaluate all the activities you're undertaking and which ones to continue or which ones not to continue, the challenge as a leader or as management you're facing is to make decisions and make the cuts in a way that they cannot be associated with one organizational identity more than the other. It should still remain a bit ambiguous because otherwise you get like these heated debates. Oh, do we become this organization? I thought we were that. And like this is also where their theorizing started off from was these budget cuts that were seemingly insignificant at their university that really made them rethink like, okay, what type of organization are we as a university?
Well, that's a good way to say that, Greta, because oftentimes what leaders will do is to reduce the conflict and the turmoil is they'll just do what the authors called in the paper across the board cuts. Because like you said, if you're going to say, we're just going to stop doing this thing or this other department's going to get cut more, then you have essentially said, if implicitly, that other department's not as important. And that's a very difficult decision and statement to get other members to accept, particularly the people in the department that don't get the money. And then you go back to these kind of grieving issues of like, well, how does that affect their personal identity when the organization has said, you're not really that important to the organization, so we're cutting more of your
money. Like a current debate within the university context is about fundamental research and applied research, where it's easier to get external research money for applied research. So it looks like they bring in more money and this type of research is more valuable, but we also need the fundamental research, which doesn't have these short-term financial returns to it.
Yeah, we're touching on a very important debate or challenge when we try to reconcile identity with image. No question.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, okay. Happy to do that. So we're touching on a real tension between identity and image. And in a lot of ways, what that tension talks about is the difference between, first person and third person or second person perspective on the organization's identity. Because on the one hand, we can make all the claims that we want of who we are. But if it conflicts with who others say we should be, not necessarily say who we are, but say who we should be, that can be a very difficult conflict. And Wetton in the 2006 article, and it's also implied in the 1985 book chapter, is that if you have an identity crisis of that variety where an organization is forced to question who they are, that could be fatal to the organization. And there's no question that resources, when we're talking about an organization whose identity, ability to sustain its identity is dependent on external resources, then that organization is always going to face an identity threat at every turn. I mean, it almost becomes part of its central character is how do we deal with threats?
That's what I was just thinking. It's part of their organizational identity. That's right. That sort of hostile environment they're in. That's
okay.
A good way to say it.
And hostile environment is going to be a good segue for part three, because I think that would be a good one where I can start off with a little bit more about the Africa Command story.
And that's all for part two of episode 47. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Albert and Wenton's 1985 work on organizational identity, here on Talking About Organizations.